Grab your trowel and a cup of coffee, as you're listening to Archaeo Cafe. And I'm your host, Otis Crandell. Welcome to another episode of Archaeo Cafe. I'm Otis, and today I'm talking with Klaus Kropp of the Lauresham Open Air Laboratory for Experimental Archaeology in Lorsch, Germany. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What is the main focus of your research?
When I think about what I do most at the Open Air Lab is that we try to cope with topics which were basically back then not really noteworthy. So one of my main research focus, for example, is early medieval agriculture, because it is something which was a basic thing for survival back then. And more than 90% of the population back then was working in agriculture. They grew their own food. They had to work in agriculture for their lords, for example. And so it's really interesting to dive into that topic, as when you look at the written sources, you have a macro level. You can observe it and understand it, but how it was actually done, you usually don't get. And that is where, for example, experimental archaeology kicks in. And that is what I really like about my research.
What made you interested particularly in the medieval period?
Well, it all started with my study at the University of Heidelberg, where one of my study topics was medieval history. And I always liked topics which were closely connected to, well, as I already said, the micro level, crafts, and also agriculture. And I also always thought that there's much more to know about that specific topics, whereas most of the general research is more focusing on, well, meta topics. At the University of Heidelberg, there is, for example, transcultural study, a topic, rituals, for example. And I was always more focusing on the little things, and which at the same time basically were the basis and the foundation and the most important part of the society back then.
I guess farming was one of the key things for most people's lives back in the medieval period.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about that is that although it was so present in the everyday lives of the people back then, we know so little about it. We only know what, for example, the large monasteries or the kings wrote down in order to organize this. So when it comes to how they actually did it, we don't know so much about it. And there are not really perfect preservation. There's always, not always, the best preservation. For example, for plows, we only have sometimes the iron parts of that plows left, like the share or the coulter. But the whole tilling implements themselves are usually in a complete way not preserved. And this is really interesting to cope with that.
What are some of the main differences between farming in the medieval period and today?
When we think about medieval agriculture, we have to basically, in a first step, say goodbye to what we consider as our economic thinking. When it's not a market economy in the Middle Ages, it is an economy which clearly has subsistence strategies still in place, like strategies focusing around risk minimization and diversification. So when we think about medieval farming, we have to think about different ways of or different types of fields they used, more different varieties of crops they used. Basically, these are things which were still common until the 1950s, maybe, or at least until the Industrial Revolution. But when we look at the Middle Ages, many things we today consider as sustainable farming were still in place there and made the agricultural process more flexible also to react on crises like droughts, for example. If you use really broad variety of different crops, you might be able to react better on a drought because this particular crop is better coping with a drought or rain. There were also and very often more specialized varieties which only were used in a particular region because there was that many rain every year and it was a little bit higher in altitude. So there were, well, basically the agriculture back then, much more than today, was local and locally specialized. And this is something we can also learn from when we look at today's agriculture, especially industrialized agriculture, where we try to basically use general varieties which are used everywhere throughout the country, but we need the fertilizer and we need, for example, different types of pesticides to actually make them more adjustable to the local conditions of the weather and so on.
You're researching early medieval agriculture, but you're investigating the subject using some different methods than most archaeologists and historians use. A lot of your research takes place at an experimental archaeology open-air laboratory. Can you tell our listeners what is an experimental archaeology open-air laboratory?
What we try to circumscribe with that title basically is our approach to try to get as close as possible to what you would consider as a laboratory where you can make actual valuable scientific research. What you need to do in order to do good experimental archaeology, you will have to develop a clear question first, of course. Then you will have to try to document as many possible parameters of your research in order to get a clear and basically also a result which can be repeated, basically. So what we try to do in an open-air setting is to provide these parameters of research. So when we think about early medieval agriculture, we do that. We try to use authentic methods doing so. We use draft cattle, which were the most important source of draft power in the early Middle Ages. We use reconstructed medieval plows to do so. But what we then do is also analyze the soil we're working on, for example. We do document the microclimate, not only the temperature, air temperature and air humidity, but also the soil temperature and the soil humidity down to 90 centimeters under the ground. And therefore, we try to basically collect as much data as possible to make it a valuable and really clear scientific experiment. Of course, and this divides us from a classical laboratory, it is not always possible to replicate an experiment because only 5 minutes later, the weather can be different. And when you sow your field from hand, although you basically become a quite skilled person doing so after a couple of years, nevertheless, the seeds won't fall in the same place every time you do so because the wind might be there. So it's not 100% the same like a experiment in a real lab when we stay into the context of that agricultural field. We do also other experiments which are going about, for example, indoor climate in early medieval houses. We have many of these house models, and we try to find out how the the people actually lived in these houses and how we might have to adjust some of our, experience from or knowledge derived from written sources and have to adjust them maybe if we do experiments and see, okay, how was the difference of temperature inside the house in comparison to outside of the house? How did the heat spread from the fireplace in the house, and how bad was the air in these houses, for example? So on many, many different levels, we try to research the early medieval period in a way, using experimental archaeology especially. We couldn't do it on a classical archaeological dig or when we would work with written sources, for example. The interesting task we have at the Open Air Lab, which makes my work so much interesting for me, is that we not only use experimental archaeology to approach these questions, but also we would call it to look over your plate. Basically, you have to consider the written sources, the iconographic sources, you have to look at the archaeological evidence, but you also have to look at ethnographic sources. The ethnographic comparison is really, really important, because maybe 150 years ago, when you look at historic pictures, you will see basically the exact same technique of plowing or harnessing, which was already in use 1,200 years ago. So you basically have to include all these sources, also archaeozoological evidence, archaeobotanic evidence, in order to get really a clue of what was really going on. This is what also makes our work really interdisciplinary, and I see the Open Air Lab also as a playground of research. We live from cooperations with others because we can't be expert in every field.
I guess one of the difficulties of regular archaeology is that the events and the people and the lives that we're studying are not in progress while we study them. We're seeing the remains long after the events have happened. The people have long since gone. And I think that gives us only one perspective. We're seeing at the very end of it what was left over. In fact, not even just what was left over, but what actually survived until today. So I think it's very interesting to use experimental archaeology to observe these things as they're happening. I guess in a way it's also experiential, because you are sort of taking the role of the people that you're studying and trying to observe it at least partially through their eyes, the way they would see things in progress, a bit like ethnographic research, but for the past.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a change of perspective, which makes this field so interesting. And it's basically the same process we have to go through every time we want to reconstruct something, or construct something would be the right term for it, because for reconstruction, you basically know how the original actually looked like 100%. And we try to get as close as possible, but what you sometimes have is a product or the rest of a finished product, and then have to start thinking about what tools were used to actually get to that product. And then you have at some point also have to try out stuff with the system of false right and wrong and error, and then you get that experiential image you were already talking about. So not everything is a clear scientific experiment. This experiential part is also very important, a part of the process, basically, especially when I think the Open Air Lab not only as a scientific institution, but also, and this is basically our reason for existence, to be a place to explain visitors' everyday life, the manorial system, crafts of the early Middle Ages. It is really, really good to have some practical experience in that field. It is a totally different story to tell people something about early medieval house building or agriculture if you haven't already worked on a project like this before. If you know the tools, you can explain these tools in a totally different way. And this is also why it is a real important part of the training of our staff to actually make them experience and learn some skills in a broad variety of crafts, be it blacksmithing, turning, spinning, weaving, tablet weaving. They go through a long series of different training sessions. But then again, you have a lot higher quality when it comes to coping with the visitors.
What are some of the other advantages of experimental archaeology over some of the more common methods used in archaeology and history?
Well, let me put it this way. An advantage can be also to provide classical archaeological approaches with some new perspectives. If you, for example, think about long-term experiments which go on in archaeological open-air museums or open-air labs throughout the world, we can not only document the house-building process, for example, but also the decomposition process of a house after it burned down or just fell apart after 10 or 20 years. And knowing how it actually looked like can provide field archaeologists with valuable information on how the archaeological evidence actually is becoming what it is that 1 or 2,000 years later. So this is something which is a really interesting aspect of experimental archaeology, being able to provide insights and help for practical field archaeology.
What types of activities do you do as part of your research? What would be some typical things that you would do most days?
Well, if we leave aside the administration I have to do, which takes up quite a large amount of time, and also promotion, PR and stuff. But when we think about actual work at the Open Air Lab, we do work on our various projects on a regular basis. This means, for example, as we have a strong focus on medieval agriculture, we usually every week work also with our draft cattle, and also spend not small amount of time of training draft cattle. We have, for example, this year, three volunteers in a voluntary ecological year, something which you can do in Germany for 1 year. And the year project of these three volunteers is the draft cattle training. And so we do various training sessions, basically train the next generation of draft cattle we need in our agricultural tasks later when it is the right time of the year. This is also something I had to adjust to when I started the work here, is that many tasks, when you think about agriculture, are, well, they're seasonal tasks. You can't do plowing if it's not the right time. And this is sometimes not as easy as you think, because you're not a full-time early meal farmer. You also have to run a museum, and therefore you have to make time to actually do the job on the field, but also do everything else to keep that museum or open air museum running. Of course, we also have to think about more profane things we have to take care of in the daily routine. The animals have to be fed. The gardens have to be taken care of. We work on basically repairing stuff, which is also another experiential thing, which is quite good. If something's broken, one of the houses or fences, and we have to fix it, and also try also to document what we're doing there, of course. So there's standard stuff happening every day. There's our research projects we work on, documentation, also working with colleagues, doing, of course, when it comes to me as the manager of the site, I'm doing sometimes specific guided tours to universities, or even when I do teaching at university, I come with university courses and we do practical experiments on various fields. Also, we build a iron smelting furnace, or we do actually plowing, which is always fun thing to experience for a student to actually be in behind a reconstructed plow and an ox, for example. And there's also, when it comes to the more quiet time of autumn and winter, on site, I spent a quite amount of time in actually planning the next season, and of course do write on various papers. We have a research magazine coming out every second year. The next one will be coming out in March 2021, and we basically try to publish all our experiments as good as possible. And so basically you have to do some writing throughout the year, and especially in winter time, so the next issue can get out.
How much of what you do involves comparison with modern or relatively modern pre-industrial methods of farming?
Well, what we had to learn is that when it comes to the harvest of crops from the early Middle Ages on our experimental fields, it's quite time consuming. So as a joke, and I sometimes tell in guided tours to our visitors that I'm missing the 40 servants of the early Middle Ages to do it all 100% authentic. So when we actually harvest a field using sickles, this takes up a large amount of our time, and you can ask yourself, is it worth spending so much time on this task if you actually can harvest it with more modern equipment, maybe some ox drawn equipment? You can do it 10 times faster, but nevertheless, you have your crops later in your hand, and you can still do a research on it and use the seeds from that rye or whatever you're harvesting. So sometimes we have to decide whether it's worth to do it as authentic as possible, or to adjust a little bit and use more modern equipment to actually get the job done. We could also think about getting all the manure on the fields with hand. But on the other hand, it's way easier to use a tractor to actually get it next to the field and then do it by hand. So we have to adjust there too. And one other thing we sometimes very well aware decide to do it not authentic is when it comes to questions of, for example, animal welfare. We have to do stuff in a really modern way if there are veterinary rules. So if your livestock has to get yellow ear tags because you're a part of the European Union, you just have to do it. This is everything but authentic. When it comes to the draft cattle usage at the open air lab, we decided against use of more authentic yoking of the cattle decided to better use a three-pet harness, which was not developed before the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, because it's more animal friendly. We try to show our visitors the authentic ways of harnessing and yoking cattle, but nevertheless, when it comes to hard work, we thought it would be better for the animals to be healthy for a longer time. And it's not something the visitors wouldn't understand. Actually, that is something which you can really put on the positive side when you come into a dialogue with the visitors. You say, well, we decided to do this more authentic because we think it's better for the animal. And when you keep that in mind when you document your experiments, this is, some regular mistake in the statistics you can work with.
So it depends on what are the objectives of each experiment. Some of them, it may not matter which method you use because it's not affecting the data you'll get, and you may be able to do it more efficiently and still get the data that you want.
Exactly.
Where do you get practical information about farming methods that may have been used in the early medieval period?
The thing is, we have to use that already mentioned wide variety of sources to get a, well, the big picture, basically. What we do, me being a trained historian also, is that I also, of course, look at the written sources and see what kind of information about the various topics we're working with we can derive from the written sources. There's a comment from a 9th century source of the manorial system. It's a comment from a former abbot of that Abbey of Prim, which writes a comment to that source of the 9th century from a 13th century perspective. And the interesting thing is that he comments on agricultural processes, for example, and says, well, it's not worth mentioning how it was done because everybody knows how it's done. So why would everybody write it down? And this is sometimes can be frustrating, of course, if even the people back then thought it's not noteworthy. And then you, on the other hand, can, well, relax a bit because you probably won't find anything, didn't miss anything because it was something which was so, well, common, and they wouldn't necessarily write it down. But nevertheless, of course, you have to look at the written sources. You have to also include the iconographic sources. Of course, have to use the same methods of having a clear, objective look at these sources, also pictorial sources, because it is not clear that what the person is drawing, he or she actually knew how it actually looked like. Maybe there were some factors you had to use to make it look like a plow, but let me put it differently. When you're asked to draw a plow, probably many people will recognize it as a plow, but nevertheless, it doesn't mean it represents a functional plow, what you were drawing there, so or painting there. So you have to, we would call it source criticism, Quellenkritik in German, which you always have to do also when using pictorial sources. Then again, of course, the archaeological evidence we have to look at. The problem with these is that it's fragmentary and you don't get the whole picture. You, of course, can then compare it to the pictorial sources and the written sources and the ethnographic sources you have to include. And this is where you then get on the right path to basically get a more authentic construction of these tools or the implements. What we should never forget when it comes to everyday life is, of course, also the evidence we get from, for example, the animal bones or the plant remains. Therefore, archaeobotanic and archaeozoological evidence is not a real important source of knowledge we have to basically have a really close look at. Yeah, so it's a broad variety of sources you have to look at in order to really get the question going.
I guess that in a lot of medieval or even earlier societies, there would have been a lot of people that didn't know how to write, and a lot of information was passed on orally. And as you said, they didn't consider it terribly noteworthy. And the people who were writing down things may have been writing down things that they needed to remember. And if it was something that everyone already knew, I guess there was no reason to write it down because everyone already knew it.
Exactly. And when you think about who was writing down something, you always on a regular basis have the high level, and you have the large monastic sites organizing their large belongings, and then you had to organize it on a macro level. You had to say, well, or you had to know what farmstead had to give what every year. You had to know how big that farmstead was, but why would you write down how they should plow their field, or how the different stuff you had to bring to the manorial sites was actually built. This was something the farmer had to know, and you only had to make sure that you would get it at the end of the year.
As part of your research, how much of your time is spent on studying archaeological artifacts?
When it comes to the archaeological evidence, it stands often at the beginning of our various research projects. So it takes up quite a large amount of time to actually look at the sources. When I take, for example, the XR twinning project we do together with UCT Dublin, we try to get an image of how early medieval Irish plowing worked, and we try to replicate, derived from the archaeological evidence, early medieval art. So we spend hours and hours of time to actually trying to interpret the archaeological evidence, try to think about, in this case, the wooden parts of that plow which would fit to that iron plowshare. So this is something which stands in most of the cases at the beginning of our research, and then has to be, we have to include the other sources and try to get a better image and start to interpret the evidence.
So it's part of the initial information collecting before you design the experiment.
Or at the early stage of the experiment. When you think about an experimental archaeological project, yes, we would first look at what we have before we would even think about actually doing a replica or a construction of this plow.
How much of your work do you think is based on historical documents? You mentioned that there's a lack of documents about particular topics, and that you have to go to other sources. In general, if you looked at all of your sources of information before you create the experiment, what portion of it do you think is based on written documents?
It depends a little bit on the topic, but when it comes to questions of everyday life, it can go down to maybe 1/4 or even less than 25% of the data we actually use at the final stage.
It's quite a little. I think that a lot of people, when they're thinking about history, they're imagining that there are libraries full of books and manuscripts about a lot of these topics, and they don't realize that, in fact, a lot of this information is not necessarily lost, but that it was never written down. These books of knowledge don't exist as they might today.
Yeah, the interesting part about that is when you think about teaching at university and you teach a history course on medieval agriculture, you first have to set the stage, so to speak, for the students that throughout the semester, you won't necessarily only work with written sources, but work with a broad variety of sources. First have to learn how to, it starts basically being able to read and understand the publications of the fellow colleagues from the other disciplines. So you have to, broaden your perspective, and you realize the limitations of your own source material you work with. This isn't a problem. You as a historian, you'll be the expert from the written sources. You can derive everything you want, or as much as possible from that. But it is a matter of taking the other discipline serious in order to really get a better result at the end. I often experience that when you're an archaeologist, you see sometimes the historians or the written sources as a, let's call it help science. And also, for example, the archaeozoological evidence is something nice to publish as well. But it would be way better. And this is something we're working on. And thank God it's already happening throughout Europe and the world, that all these different disciplines better get together on a really early stage and work on
shared research questions, because then you really have the chance to get more information out of the question or the topic you're working on.
What are some of the most interesting things that you've learned during your research? Were there some things that were unexpected or that surprised you upon learning them?
One of the most interesting results or experiences was basically the level of skill the people back then had. When we think about replicating different techniques, be it house building or when it comes to metal processing or, different types of crafts, basically, we sometimes spend hours and weeks of time to actually try to get an idea how they did that particularly technique done. Sometimes it seems easy, but it's the level of perfection they did that. And something I really like when it comes to the early Middle Ages especially is that you have the chance, especially in that open air museum setting we're working in, to educate the people that the Middle Ages were everything but primitive, and that they were working on the highest possible level in their different professions, in their time setting they were living in. So this is something which really is fascinating of that period, the skills that people back then already had, and of course the knowledge in different fields they had to be aware of in one single person. So it's not like there were so many different professions. Everybody had to be skilled or in different fields in order to get the job done, because you couldn't go into that job or order a craftsman for that topic. You were in many cases on your own. Of course, there were some crafts which were really specialized, and not everybody could do it, but in some cases or some parts of your everyday life, you actually had to learn a lot, and this started already as a child.
What would you say is the most interesting project that you've worked on?
Well, I would say the most interesting project would be our agriculture project we're still working on, because it is especially this project where I see that coming from a medieval perspective, we can also play our part in answering questions of the 21st century. This is what I really like at that project, because we produce relevant data which actually help us or might help us cope with or working on a more sustainable future.
Are there any other practical benefits or other aspects of your work that you think are relevant to society today?
Well, besides thinking about the agricultural project I already talked about, it is the preservation of ancient crafts and also a value added chain of handmade products we were able to promote a bit in our museum setting there. We have many crafts which are on the edge of extinction, but nevertheless are valuable and really important parts of our cultural heritage. And when we, as a museum, Open Air Project, are able to not only support the craftsmen, actually, which are still skilled in that, but also, maybe even help preserve the knowledge or expand the knowledge in that particular field, that's a really good thing, and that's a valuable thing. And when I think about our current society, where and I hope I don't step on a toe of somebody here, we basically have a society which is or can be characterized as a society which I would call a throw out or throw away society, that we are not entirely valuing especially handmade products anymore. If you maybe just have a hole in your sweatshirt, for example, you probably wouldn't spend much time in repairing it. You probably would buy a new one because it's so cheap. And when you think about this medieval societies, you have a society in front of you which didn't have that opportunity, which had to value that handmade products way more. And if we think about early medieval textiles, we, in most cases, when they're quite completely preserved, you would see signs of repairments everywhere. And what I also think is something we should, well, at least be aware of and think about it for a bit, is when we think about house building to some extent today, it's not house building for eternity anymore. Of course, medieval houses weren't built for eternity, but it was the sense of details, a sense of decorating, a sense of, well, how do I phrase that correctly? Love for the thing you do, basically. When you think about a house wall, a clay wall of the 17th century, which is still preserved, there's probably not a single part of that wall not decorated. And this is something I really like about that. This is something we should think about when we build houses today, which are actually already planned in for destruction 30 or 40 years after that. It's also, well, you could also call it being more on the ground and more leveled with your surroundings back then than today.
Can you tell us a bit more about the Lauwersham Laboratory for Experimental Archaeology?
The Lauwersham Open Air Laboratory was originally designed as a expansion of the didactic concept of the existing UNESCO World Heritage Site Lorsch Abbey, which has the difficulty that most of the former monastic site is gone by now. And when you stay in front of that former monastery today, we have regular questions of visitors which ask us where the monastery actually is, and they're standing right in front of it. Most of it is archaeological evidence today. There's not many buildings still standing. And then again, you have questions which aren't centering around monastic culture per se all the time, but many people ask questions about everyday culture of back then. They ask about the manorial system, and they ask about crafts and agriculture, about food and ways of actually getting your stomach full at the end of the day. So we try to think about possible ways to get a better, entry in that field of our education process. And then we had, first it was just an idea, had the idea to create a scale 1-to-1 model of a early medieval manorial site, which would or should be basically based on archaeological evidence of southwestern Germany, and then would actually be able to function as a didactic expansion of the existing museum and site. And then there was the crisis of 2009, where there was a program started from our government on an investment project for national cultural heritage sites. And Lorsch applied for it, and in the period of 2010 to 2014, the amount of almost 12 million euros was invested to make the experience of visiting that site more lively and better. And the biggest project of this wider project was actually having the chance to create that what scale one-to-one model of that early medieval manor. And that is how the OpenL laboratory came into existence as a didactic model, so to speak, for the existing World Heritage Site of Lorsch Abbey, but also, and this is what makes it maybe unique in a way, functioning as a research facility to follow the same path as the monastic site today, to also being able to provide valuable research into the period of the early Middle Ages. The site today is a little bit larger than 4 hectares. We have the inner manorial site behind the palisade, where you would have the lord's house and the servants' houses and some minor crafts base, but then you have the outskirts, so to speak, of that manorial site, where you would have most of the crafts placed. Also, this based on archaeological evidence, where you would not put a smithy or a dyeing house next to your living house because of the problems with fire or problems of smell, for example. This is another part of the site. And then we have a large portion, which is meadows and fields and gardens. And we try to put much thought into details. Every house is completely equipped with what you would think should have been in a servant's house 1,200 years ago. But I have to admit that, of course, when you built that on a green meadow in the year 2000, between 2012 and 14, it doesn't really look like it was an early medieval manorial site, because everything is new. Every single piece of equipment is new. And it took us a couple of years to actually get the thing going in a way that it actually looks like people lived in these houses. It actually smells like people lived in these houses. And we, of course, acquired a lot of more equipment out of our experience or working together with cooperation partners, which makes it more authentic today than it was a couple of years ago. And of course, we also now have completely different situation when it comes to building new house constructions. When I think about the constellation when we started, was, well, we have a large amount of money. Have to, on the other hand, basically spend all the money in a very narrow time frame. So you had to do some compromises when it came to actually building the houses. You couldn't document everything as you wanted it to be. There was sometimes modern equipment involved. There was a telescope forklifter, which actually helped us put up the beams, or the craftsmen to put up the beams. So there, the first stage of buildings is really models. And now we have the possibility, after we opened and we had a little time to breathe, so to speak, we can start setting up clear experiments, which actually can be called experimental archaeological experiments in this case. So when we build a new house model today, we spend at least half a year investigating what kind of building we want to build, how it might have been used, or how specific building techniques were done. And then we take our time to do so. And we document every single piece of the coming into birth of that building. So only after a couple of years of being actually opened, we now really start to function as the place we really want to be, being in OpenL laboratory.
You're also the scientific manager of the laboratory. What does this job involve?
This job basically involves, when it comes to the scientific part of it, of actual scientific work, actually monitoring the different projects on site, actually doing and conducting the experiments on site. But a large portion of that part of my job also means to work on active cooperations with different partners, be it universities, be it other museums, open air sites, and also associations like XARC. Networking is a really important task within that scientific managing of the Open Air Laboratory.
What are your plans for the future?
Well, looking at the future, I hope we can actually keep up the pace and actually be able to do the documenting of the various projects, especially when it comes to agriculture, on a real long-term perspective, because I think that's the real chance we have here. Doing these experiments for 10 to 20 years would actually put us in a position where we would really have lots and lots of valuable data. You can't actually build much on 1 or 2 years of experimenting in that field. You have to go for the long term, and I hope that we'll be able to actually do so and have enough staff and enough funding to actually be able to do so. And when it comes to plans for the future, of course, we always have other projects in mind. I would really, this was the project from right at the beginning, the first stage of our project, that it would be really, really interesting to think about constructing an early medieval mill. This would be something really interesting also from a technological point of view, and also when it comes to telling the story of the manorial system, where mills played a really important part in that manorial control you would have on your servants. So this would be a great addition to our story, and we could work together with different institutions to actually go for that goal. And as a site are quite close to water, not only the mill topic is interesting, but when I think about possible cooperations, I would also find it interesting to work on a Carolingian boat construction. This would be really interesting. And yeah, I could go on now, and while talking probably would produce 10 more ideas. So right. I think we're basically good to go for the long term with when it comes to ideas. The bigger question then would be how to get the funding to do it all.
So there's no shortage of ideas. There's no shortage of things that could be investigated or that your team would like to investigate. It's simply a matter of resources and prioritizing them.
Exactly. And also maybe self-limitation is a factor which sometimes hurts, but is something you better do, as when you do too many projects at the same time, quality-wise, you may lose a bit for the particular projects themselves. So better do some stuff really on a high level and wait for the others a couple more years.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to do similar work in experimental archaeology, either of the medieval period in general or of the history of agriculture?
When it comes to the education in that field, I would suggest at a really early stage of the study to look and see, find a university which at least has a connection, affiliation to experimental archaeologists. Thank God today some of the universities have a stronger experimental archaeological focus, or for example master's programs in this respect. This is something you should really go for. When I think about the German speaking landscape, you might have to look at universities which at least work with sites like ourselves and do some teaching in that field. It is really important to get an insight in this particular field as early as possible, and try to get also just some practical experience, not only because it's really fun to do so and a valuable part of the general education in that field, but also to get contacts on an early stage. use XArc as a perfect network to actually get to know where the various institutions are based, who is working in experimental archaeology. And if you think about a project you have to do in university in class, well, why not think about an experimental archaeological approach and contacting some experimental archaeologists, which may have already worked in that field.
Is this something that you would recommend people get into at the undergrad level, or simply start thinking about it then and start to specialize in it at the master's level?
Well, it depends. I think a general education in the field of archaeology is something which should be done at an undergrad level, of course, because you don't understand, or you can't be of any help for field archaeology, for example, if you didn't study it in a proper way. So I wouldn't say it is a problem if you didn't go into experimental archaeology on a bachelor level or undergrad level. When it comes to the master's level, it of course can be a good thing to do when you think about really diving into that field and really focusing most of your research in that field, because there's a lot of practical experience and theoretical experience and knowledge you have to acquire to do it on a higher level. For, talking about myself, I didn't have the possibility to get a proper education at university in that field, and it took me years to at least get to a level where I would consider myself as an experimental archaeologist. Takes up a lot of time and experience.
Are there any particular skills, training, or other forms of education that you would recommend people get very early on?
When I think about the institutions which today work in the field of experimental archaeology, I can only recommend students not only to do their internships at classical institutions, being archives or being universities or being research facilities, but also consider museums and archaeological open air museums as a valuable place to be and learn experience, because in many cases it's these institutions which have to basically cope with all the different aspects of that topic or that field. You be working a museum job, you will have to do cooperations with universities, you will have to think about possible ways to actually present knowledge on different levels, and therefore you get a really broad image. And so I can only recommend to do internships in museums or consider them as well, and not only do digs or internships, as I already mentioned, but also do them at the museums.
You've given us a lot to think about in terms of how we can combine archaeology, history, and various other subjects, along with practical experience from replicating past activities and lifestyles. It's been particularly interesting to hear about how researchers study the everyday life, specifically in an agricultural setting, of people in the medieval period. I hope this will inspire some young researchers and give them some ideas about things that they might investigate and how they might do it. But thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Have a good day then.
You too, bye.
You've been listening to the Archaeo Cafe podcast. For more information and news, check out our website or social media pages. Links can be found in the episode notes or simply by searching online for Archaeo Cafe podcast. If you have any questions or comments for the presenters or guest speakers, we'd love to hear from you. And remember, don't be dismissive of people of the past. After all, they did learn how to do amazing things without needing to resort to Wikipedia, Google, or smartphones.